You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Welcome to the Cycling Podcast. Our Tour de France Attitude Camp starts here. This is the first of four weekly episodes of Lionel, let's call them vertical mindset meters, that will take us to the Tour's Grand Depart in Barcelona, where myself, Graham Wilgos, and you, Lionel Burney, will begin our second three-week road trip as normal men following the peloton around, well, a little corner of Spain and then France. In the meantime, Lionel, you're in the Sierra, not Watford. And I'm currently about 7 meters above sea level at the base of Hampton Hill.
Well, we were going to meet face to face, weren't we, on the South Bank in London, our Sierra Nevada, to podcasting world, our Attitude Camp's home venue. But we had to invoke the extreme weather protocol, didn't we? The weather's not been great.
Yeah.
We had the heat wave here in the UK last week. It's now turned, well, it feels autumnal almost, windy and rainy. Not ideal conditions for outdoor podcasting. So we...
Not without a serious rain jacket.
Yeah, this is very much indoor podcasting. So we haven't yet met face to face. I mean, we don't want to give the impression that you've been in hibernation, Graham, since the Tour of Britain last year. We have met face to face several times over the last few months, but this is our build up to the 2026 Tour de France. And yeah, we'll be on the road again in a few weeks' time.
Before we go any further, we should also say a hearty congratulations to Daniel and Michele Pellacci and Brian Nygaard on their Giro Vagando. And they're now taking a well-earned rest after 3 weeks of, well, eating nothing but prosciutto around Italy and Bulgaria. Another triumphant Giro d'Italia for them. Following on from that, when do we start calling you Bernie Lionel?
Never.
But you've got our accreditation lined up, and there might have been a faux pas with that.
Yes, I've applied for the Tour de France accreditation, and I've filled out the form incorrectly. So I've put down my first name as Bernie and my second name as Lionel. So I'm anticipating my accreditation badge being incorrect. But, you know, c'est la vie. It's these things happen, don't they? Sometimes you see the captions on the TV, don't you? Thomas Geraint was the caption on the TV for a number of years, wasn't it? Because presumably at some point the paperwork for the UCI had been filled in incorrectly and the race organisers all had the wrong information. So, I'll be Bernie Lionel for the Tour de France. It's fine. But just to echo what you said there, Graham, the Giro d'Italia coverage by Daniel, Michele and Brian, absolutely first rate, wasn't it? On many occasions, many days, it was better than the race itself, I think, because the race itself lacked a little bit of drama across all of the different facets, didn't it? Jonas Vingegaard, we all expected him to win, but it was quite a sort of arm's length victory, held off Felix Gall and everybody else, rode in a kind of well-established order, didn't they? And even the battle for the Ciclamino and the blue jerseys were, well, fairly, well, formalities in the end.
Well, right at the point that the Ciclamino seemed like it was about to really hot up, Jonathan Narváez left the race, didn't he?
He did. He rode into a team bus on the way back to his team bus and gave himself quite a bad sort of bump on the head, I think, and pulled out of the next stage quite early on, dizzy, not well. Whether that has an impact on UAE Team Emirates for the Tour de France, I think he's sort of on the long list for the team to support Tadej Pogacar. But, you know, the Giro coverage has always been about a celebration of Italy. It's like going on a sort of vicarious three-week holiday with the world's best Italian tour guide, isn't it? Daniel knows every corner of the country and really brings it to life. And some of the feedback we've had from the listeners has been absolutely fantastic. So a big thank you to everyone who tuned in and everyone who's taken the time to write us a nice email or send a message on social media. But the season gallops on, doesn't it? The Giro d'Italia women is underway at the moment. Rose, Rebecca and Lizzie will be seeing the coverage home over the coming days. Denny Gray, I think, has completed his final turn on the front, but the Cycling Podcast Féminin team will see them through. They've got the big stage to Sestriere on Saturday. Those episodes are going out nightly. And the world of cycling moves on so quickly, doesn't it, Graham? Because we are now looking forward to the Critérium du Dauphiné. Sorry, we need some kind of clang. We need some kind of klaxon. It's not called the Dauphiné anymore. It's going to take me about 10 years to get used to the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes.
It's quite the mouthful, isn't it, by comparison?
I know why it's happened. The Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes region is now the sponsor of the race, so I completely get it. But yeah, it doesn't trip off the tongue quite as romantically or regally as the Dauphiné, the prince of stage races.
Do you want to get into that now, or should we dip into the newsette first?
Well, have you got a newsette item, Graham?
I certainly do, yeah. Well, sort of looking ahead, almost looking a little bit further ahead to the tour, and, well, it's kind of looking back and looking ahead all at once, because Paul Sexas, who lit up the Dauphiné when the rest of the tour, last year's Tour de France podium, weren't lighting it up, and sort of had this kind of glorious ride where the question was, when is he going to fall away? When is he going to fall away? And it eventually ended up not quite getting into the top five. He finished eighth on GC at the Dauphiné, I think it was still called the Dauphiné, last year for Decathlon, now Decathlon CMA CGM. But he's laid down a marker ahead of the tour by setting a new Strava KOM on the Tourmalet. So he's not doing much to dampen the hype around whether or not he will challenge for the GC, challenge for the podium, will challenge Tadej Pogacar and give him something else to think about, as well as Jonas Vingegaard coming into the tour, hopefully sustaining his Giro form.
Indeed. I mean, we'll talk in the next part about the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes, because I think it's really intriguing this year. Obviously, no Jonas Vingegaard, because he's just won the Giro d'Italia. No Tadej Pogacar either, because he is riding the Tour de Suisse, which starts in a couple of weeks' time. No Remco Evenepoel, unless he's planning to do a Tour of Flanders grand reveal and add himself to the start list for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe at the last minute. I don't anticipate that happening. So it really is going to be the Paul Sexas show in the French Rhône-Alpes next week. Well, it starts on Sunday, doesn't it? So shall we get into the thick of previewing the next big stop on the Paul Sexas hype train's journey towards the Tour de France?
I think so, yeah. I think that's the right thing to do. Unless you wanted to just mention our mate Dave Brailsford's influence at net company Ineos growing seemingly, well, by the day, and John Aller having left the team a day before the Giro. I think I'm right in saying he left the day before the Giro started. And it always felt like John Aller, the former, well, now former CEO of what was Ineos, now net company Ineos, it always felt like he was sort of operating in Dave Brailsford's shadow. And there was that kind of big question around Brailsford's role in the team when he came back to the tour, or came back to sort of really be part of the day-to-day running of the team at the tour last summer. And kind of being around the buses and him sort of saying, oh, you know, I'm just here to kind of get a feel for it again. I've been away a long time, and racing's changed, and I'm really just here to sort of oversee a few bits and pieces and try and get up to speed again. But there was always that question, and we talked about it a lot last summer, over, well, what is he doing back here and how much influence does he have? And this would seem to confirm the fact that he, although Ineos have not yet confirmed his job title, although my understanding is, and our colleague Chris Marshall-Bell deserves a lot of credit for this, for the piece that he's written for The Athletic in the past week, Brailsford is described as team principal in the slides shown during the team's rebrand earlier in the year, which I know you went along to, the net company Ineos rebrand. So Aller, having joined in a consultancy role and subsequently being promoted to CEO in December 2023, obviously with the task of reviving Ineos is fading fortunes, is now his association with the team is now no more. And it would seem like it's a kind of very much a, well, with Geraint Thomas as kind of head of racing, it's the Dave, well, back to being the Dave Brailsford show.
Yeah, I don't think there was any doubt about this. I mean, I went along to the big reveal of Net Company as the new title sponsor of the team just before the Giro. It was about a week and a half before the Giro started, wasn't it? And Dave Brailsford was back, you know, at the top table, so to speak. I don't think there was any surprise that he would reassume that role as the undisputed kind of head honcho of the team. And John Alert's departure had been kind of mooted in recent months as well. So it will be interesting. They still, I think, have a lot of catching up to do when it comes to closing the gap to UAE Team Emirates and Visma Lisa Bike especially. But I guess that journey starts here. And it's not the only big managerial change that's been confirmed in recent days, is it? Because the Lidl Trek team has announced that Luca Guercellena, who has had a long association with that team, will be stepping back after the Tour de France. Grisha Neerman will be joining Lidl Trek from Visma Lisa Bike as head of racing. And a sort of musical chairs of management and coaches, isn't it? Because Jonas Vingegaard's former coach, Tim Heemskerk, has been confirmed as Remco Evenepoel's new coach at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. So a real musical chairs of team managers and coaches. Whether all of those changes will have an impact on the upcoming Tour de France might be a bit too soon, but definitely, lots of changes afoot. Let's face it, what are the kind of the biggest teams making the biggest financial investments in the sport? You know, the results, they need to follow, don't they? The money goes in first and the results need to follow. So it's kind of sort of looking a little bit like football in terms of mid-season changes and coaches moving on, managerial roles being altered mid-season. We saw it last year, didn't we, with Matt White leaving Jayco Alula very close to the Giro d'Italia, you know, for what was, we assume, performance-related issues. The pressure, I think, is really on, especially the squads that are spending, you know, big budgets that aren't maybe delivering the results that they may expect for that money.
I think so. I think that's right to compare it to football as well, in that you are seeing it, or it feels like we're seeing it a lot more mid-season, whereas before teams might have waited until the end of the year to make those changes. Now it sort of feels not quite kind of sack race, but very much kind of quick fire. Change it up if it's not, don't be afraid to change it up if it's not working.
Are we going to get people on mountainsides chanting, "You're getting sacked in the morning," at the team cars as they go past? I think I'd give up on cycling if I mean, I'm all for football, I love football, but let's keep the cultures and the etiquette separate, shall we?
Yeah, I think that's right. One more, delving back into the news at one last time before we do finally get to the preview of the Dauphiné, of the, sorry, Beep. Tour of Rhône-Alpes. Yeah. one more kind of roadside thing to mention. And so it's focused on the Tour's Grand Départ in Barcelona. So in a joint statement released on Tuesday, the Catalan National Assembly and the Omnium Cultural Organization said that they will organize demonstrations along the race route. But they were at pains to say that it doesn't appear that their plans will disrupt or interfere with the race itself. But you can kind of in that kind of typically enthusiastic and sort of fiercely independent Catalan way, it seems like we can expect a kind of a notable or noticeable presence on the roadside in Barcelona. The only thing you can say, I suppose, about those two organisations that have put their name to this statement is that they are, I was talking to an old colleague, Spanish journalist, whose name I won't mention, but he sort of said that the Catalan National Assembly is quite a mainstream and centre organisation, and Omnium Cultural are sort of centre-left to left-leaning. And so their MO is not necessarily to be disruptive in the way that you might expect when you hear the word protest. And so it's hopeful And this, I don't want to sort of delve too far in, or go too far down the road of speculation. But it's, they are not sort of one of the more disruptive organizations. So we will see.
So this is Catalan independence, in support of Catalan independence, rather than a kind of a movement to disrupt the race. I mean, the people of Barcelona and Catalonia especially will see this as a Catalan Grand Depart rather than a Spanish Grand Depart. And I suppose they will want to make that distinction clear. And we'll sort of take the temperature of that when we get to Barcelona in a few weeks' time, Graham.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network in the world. It's so easy to use. You just connect with one click and pretty much forget all about it. And you have access to more than 9,500 servers across 149 countries. And all of those virtual locations are keeping your data safe and secure whenever you're on the internet. It's really quick too. It doesn't slow down your internet connection too much or at all. Certainly one of the fastest VPNs out there. And one NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 devices. It supports all major platforms. So whether you use a Windows phone or an Android or an Apple, it will work seamlessly. Go to nordvpn.com/TCP. And as you listen to the cycling podcast, you'll get a great deal when you sign up for a 2-year plan. You'll get 4 months extra for free. It's risk-free as well because Nord has a 30-day money-back guarantee. So once you've seen how NordVPN works, and if you decide, the unlikely event that you decide it's not for you, you can get your money back. But having been a NordVPN customer for so long and seen all of the various other benefits in addition to the internet security, which is the primary focus of a virtual private network, I'm confident that you'll become a long-term NordVPN customer, as I am. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP.
Right then, Lionel. The Dauphiné, or the not Dauphiné, the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. And as you mentioned, instead of last year's GC or eventual Tour de France GC top three of Tadej Pogacar, Jonas Vingegaard and Florian Lipovits, we don't have any of them this year. We're relying on Paul Sexas and probably Isaac Del Toro for UAE's main man to really set the race alight this year.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Sexas is the rider everybody will have their eyes on, not least because he won Itzulia in the Basque Country in such impressive fashion earlier in the spring. That was the first French rider to win a World Tour level stage race since Christophe Moreau in 2007, almost Paul Sexas' lifetime ago. And of course, the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes is the home race for the Decathlon team. It has its roots in that part of France. It's the home race for Paul Sexas, really, because he was born and raised in Lyon. And it really is the most anticipated appointment on Paul Sexas's calendar, now that we know he's going to be riding the Tour de France, leading the Decathlon CMA CGM team at the tender age of just 19. The expectations are going to be immense. In the team press release, he's quoted as saying he's going to the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes to try and win it. Why wouldn't he, given the performances so far this season, the way that, you know, he was able to hang on to the coattails of Tadej Pogacar at Liège-Bastogne-Liège better than anybody else? He has emerged as the sort of the third big rider to contest the Tour de France. Yeah, everyone will be looking at this battle between Jonas Vingegaard to see whether he can double up and add the Tour de France to the Giro. The big question will be how much has the Giro d'Italia taken out of Vingegaard. I would hazard a guess that, you know, he rode, you know, in the dark orange at most during the Giro, because he didn't really need to do much more to win it in what was quite a clinical but emphatic way. Tadej Pogacar, we know, will be good. We'll see him in action at the Tour de Suisse. So this week is all about Sexas. And I think for the hype a victory when you consider he'll be going up against, as you say, Isaac Del Toro for UAE Team Emirates, Matteo Jorgensen, who's coming back after his crash in Amstel Gold, Juan Ayuso, who hasn't really kind of got up to speed yet with Little Trek particularly. You know, it's a strong field, but in the absence of Vingegaard and Pogacar, it presents a fantastic opportunity for Paul Sexas to kind of burst into the consciousness of the mainstream French sporting public ahead of the Tour de France. I mean, imagine if he wins it, the expectation will be absolutely off the chart in July, won't it? And, you know, even a top three and a stage win will do little to suppress the idea that Sexas is coming up and it's only a matter of time.
He really is the coming man. It's worth going over his season so far. I mean, you mentioned this sort of here and there, his race results this season. So Algarve, he finished second on the GC, overall third on the points classification, and first in the youth classification. Itzulia Basque Country, as you say, he won that. In between those two, came second at Strade Bianche and won the Forn Ardèche Classic. Then one Flèche Wallonne, and second, hanging on to Pogacar's coattails, as you say, at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And that was his last race before the Not Dauphiné. So the expectation, huge, but totally warranted too. And the other person to mention while we're here and mentioning UAE is João Almeida, who obviously you might remember a sort of series of injuries and crashes early in the Giro, struggled, I think, with a series of injuries and crashes before the Giro, pulled out a week before the start. And so I think he is likely to make his return at the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes in support, presumably, or maybe as a two-pronged attack with Isaac Del Toro.
Yeah, I mean, Del Toro is scheduled to go to the Tour de France to be part of Pogacar's pretty formidable UAE Team Emirates squad, whereas João Almeida will probably ride the Vuelta as their team leader. So it's always interesting. What can we do here? Can we just call it the Dauphiné until eventually it sinks in sometime in the 2030s that the race name has changed? But it is the Tour de France dress rehearsal, isn't it? And everybody's coming at it with different objectives on the near horizon. They're all coming at it with different backstories to their seasons so far. And we are looking at the Paul Sexas story. I mean, it resonates so strongly for so many reasons, because he's so young, because he's been absolutely brilliant so far this season, and because of his performance in last year's Dauphiné, when it was the Dauphiné, Graham, as you mentioned. You know, that was an extraordinary performance.
We're going to write it out 100 times.
We are.
Until it sinks
as
in.
As if it's even difficult enough, us doing this two-up time trial after quite a few months off podcasting together, they throw in a race name change as well, just to completely outfox us. But last year, you know, as an 18-year-old, really, you know, in other than people who following the sport very closely, he was much more under the radar last year. Won't be the case this year. And when you look at the decathlon team that's been assembled, most of whom I think will go to the Tour de France with him, yeah, they put together a really good looking team that can support him over the week. Léo Bissio, another young Frenchman from the same region, he's unlikely to be part of the Tour de France team this year, but he will be at the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes this coming week. Aurélien Paré-Pantre, another excellent climber. Nicolas Prodhomme is in that team. You know, he's kind of the experienced old head, and we always mention it in relation to Sexas because the pair of them broke away in the Tour of the Alps in 2025 and contested that stage win together, or rather Paul Sexas allowed his older, more senior teammate to take the win. And then they've got a couple of really good time trial riders, big engines to do a lot of work on the flatter and more rolling stages, Dan Hooler and Stefan Bissiger, and then Matthew Riccitello, the American rider who is a decent GC rider in his own right. I mean, quietly, Decathlon have put together a pretty impressive squad across the board. We've also got to factor in whether Olaf Coy will get a slot in the team as a sprinter. We'll perhaps mention him a bit later in the podcast because he's not had the ideal season so far. But the pointer that I took from the Giro d'Italia watching Decathlon support Felix Gall was that they had numbers, you know, and they weren't there with their A team, but they were racing like an A team and they were racing like a GC contenders team. And I think that bodes well across the board as well. You know, they're going to gain a lot from supporting Sexas in a week-long stage race. And I think it's not ridiculous to expect Sexas to deliver. I mean, he's putting the pressure on himself by saying that he's going there to try and win. So I know some people think we're hyping up the pressure and raising the expectations, but he's not shying away from that level of expectation.
No, I mean, he very much seems to be leaning into it, doesn't he? And I totally take what you're saying about the way that Decathlon rode the Giro. And it's almost like, okay, well, this feels like the same way that we're going to ride the Tour of Rhône-Alpes and probably the same way that we're going to ride the Tour de France. If we do this now, what can we learn from it in the way that we're going to support Felix Gall, just substitute out Felix Gall for Paul Sexas? What can we learn from this that we can take into, what can we learn from riding the Giro that we can take into the Notte Dauphiné, and what can we learn from that to then take into the Tour? But this really does feel like, as you say, a quietly very, very strong team. And yeah, Matthew Riccitiello is an excellent time trialist, but he feels like he floats up mountains. I mean, I don't know whether he could have done as good a job as Felix Gall at the Giro had sort of what one been substituted out for the other. But they're not the only climbers worthy of mention in the race. Oscar Onley at Net Company Ineos is also down to start alongside Carlos Rodriguez, Kevin Vauquelin, Mikhail Kwiatkowski and Dorian Godon.
Yeah, I mean, it's another sort of strength in depth is not a problem for Net Company Ineos. But it's just whether or not Onley has got the sort of top end at this point to build on that excellent Tour de France he had last year. I mean, you know, Dorian Godon is the sort of rider who could win probably six of the eight stages if they fell his way. So it's a strong, but a bit of a steady eddy team, I think, Net Company Ineos at the moment. They are lacking a sort of Sexas, Pogacar or Vingegaard style finisher at the moment, but isn't everyone. You know, I think that's one of the other things that's interesting about both UAE Team Emirates and Visma Lisa Bike this coming week, because Isaac Del Toro, you know, there was an awful lot of hype about him simply because of the Giro d'Italia he had last year, that incredible streak of one-day race wins that he had in Italy at the back end of last year, really catapulting himself up to be second in command almost at UAE Team Emirates behind Pogacar. And now he has the opportunity to lead in a very difficult and prestigious stage race, knowing that his future role is going to be to support Pogacar at the Tour de France. I don't imagine a scenario other than Pogacar crashing or being ill where Del Toro is going to get an opportunity to ride for himself at the Tour de France. And then Visma Lisa Bike, you know, they're going to put Vingegaard back into sort of isolation and storage, and then he'll do his training block. Meanwhile, Matteo Jorgensen, who is a fantastic lieutenant to have in the mountains, needs to get himself back up to speed again, doesn't he? And, you know, a race like the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes / Dauphiné is one he could win. He's a sort of, you know, he's a bit more of a sort of diesel when it comes to the big mountains. He hasn't quite got that same sort of explosive edge, but you know, he's a very steady rider. And the big question mark though is, you know, how has his recovery gone? How has his training gone since he's been back in action since that crash that took him out of the Amstel Gold Race? And kind of, well, it's really rewritten his season, hasn't it? But there's going to be so much that we learn from the week of racing. There'll be riders that sort of, you know, when we come to evaluate them at the end of the race, some will have a sort of green arrow against their name, and other will have a question mark, and some will have a red arrow pointing downwards, you know, because are they where they need to be in terms of the Grand Départ of the Tour de France in Barcelona?
Wout van Aert and Bruno Amorai, alongside Jorgen Nordhagen, the three names currently alongside Jorgensen on the Team Visma Lisa Bike start list. Those final four places, I think I'm right in saying, yet to be confirmed. But I mean, three out of those four, you'd imagine will definitely go to the Tour, and they will all have that green tick alongside their name. UAE Team Emirates, enormously strong team, enormously strong squad, as we know. I'm going to take you back to the start of the year when you and Daniel asked me for my predictions, and I told you that Isaac Del Toro will finish second behind Tadej Pogacar at the Tour. So I think this is his chance to really show what he can do and show that he's got the form to take him that far. I don't doubt that he will, but alongside Benoit Cosnefar, Kevin Vermaak, João Almeida, Pablo Torres, Ivo Oliveira, Pavel Sivakov, who was just fantastic for Pogacar at the Tour last year, as was Tim Wellens. They round out the UAE Team Emirates squad.
There is a question mark over Del Toro, of course, isn't there? I mean, he won Tirreno Adriatico. Before that, he won the UAE Tour. So he really started the season absolutely on fire. And then, of course, crashed out of Itzulia in early April, sustained quite a bad leg injury, and has not raced since. So he, likewise, is kind of on the comeback trail. And that's what I mean about this race. It's the first opportunity we get to see a lot of riders, you know, just a month out from the start of the Tour de France. And this is really the critical period. And we'll learn a heck of a lot about who is where, who's got some ground to make up in the final weeks before the start in Barcelona, and who is exactly where they need to be. But I also think that it's a race within its own right. And that's why I'm really looking forward to seeing Seksas ride not up against Vingegaard and Pogacar. We kind of save that main course for a bit later on. First of all, we need to see whether, you know, his canapes and entrees are up to scratch before we move on to the main course.
One more name to mention, Remco Evenepoel, also on ice. He's said that he wants to start the Tour completely fresh. So he hasn't raced since Liège-Bastogne-Liège. That was his previous race day at the end of April. So very different for him compared to his build-up last year. I think I'm right in saying it'll be 69 days without racing for Remco before he starts the Tour. And, you know, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe going into the Tour of Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes with a scratch team is unfair, but it's Daniel Martinez, Mattia Cattaneo, Luke Tuckwell and Maxime Van Giel are the four names on the list for them. But they've got interests elsewhere currently. It's almost a bit of a free hit for them.
Yeah, I mean, Van Heels has had another rider with a terrible start to the season. I mean, he was all set to be the team leader at Milan-San Remo, I think, wasn't he? And then crashed in Spain in February, and he hasn't raced since mid-February. So, you know, it's a big step up from just kind of recovery and training back into a race of this difficulty and intensity. And I suppose we should talk about what is on the menu for the riders, because as you would expect, there's a lot of climbing. Not the case that there aren't opportunities for the sprinters, but they are few and far between. But it's really, it's a climber's race, isn't it? It just because of where it takes place. The opening stage from Vizille is lumpy. The next day to Le Puy-en-Velay is another kind of ruler stage. I mean, to give you an indication, Bauke Mollema won a stage of the Tour de France there in 2017. When we're watching that, Graham, look out for quite a difficult climb in the middle of the race, the Col Robert Marchand, which is named after a local cyclist who set an hour record of just over 24 kilometres at the age of 102 in 2014.
Oh, wow.
I remember this story at the time, because he was a cyclist sportive rider, often rode 100 kilometre rides. But he did an hour record, and he got the official record for the Masters 100 years plus age group. And the funny thing about
something to aspire to.
The French anti-doping people were there at the end of his ride, so it was all legit and above board. First really interesting stage is stage three, the team time trial to Perro, which is 28.4 kilometres. It's kind of rolling with an 800-metre climb at the end. And this is where we're going to see the Tour de France team time trial tactics again, because it's the same format that we'll see on the opening day of the Tour in Barcelona. The winning team is the rider who is basically the rider who crosses a line in the shortest time, but each individual rider gets their own individual time. So this is where we see this quite interesting tactical dynamic come out. The aim is to get the juicy riders to the bottom of the climb as quickly as possible and then leave them to do their thing on the final climb. And we saw a few different approaches to that at Paris-Nice, and it will be interesting to see how everyone approaches it in the Dauphiné, because that will tell us a bit about the Tour de France.
The back end of that stage has got that fast downhill section in the sort of final 10K before that real kicker back up to the finish line at Perot. It's almost like doing the team bobsleigh and then just sending the guy on the front off at the end, see what you can do in that final kind of short, sharp climb.
Yeah, I mean, I've been following the sport a long time. This reminds me of a quirky opening to the 1988 Tour de France, this time trial format. They had a race the very first day to award the yellow jersey was a préface, not a prologue. It was a préface. And it was a team time trial with all of the riders setting off. And then with 1 kilometre to go, I think it was only about 7 or 8 kilometres, but then with 1 kilometre to go, they nominated one rider from the team to then ride that last kilometre. And whoever was the fastest over that last kilometre got to wear the yellow jersey on the first road stage. And it was Guido Bontempi of the Carrera team, if I remember rightly. But I quite like this format of the team time trial. Every rider gets their own individual time, so the GC riders, you know, they're not hampered and held back to quite the same degree by the strength of the squad as a team time trial squad, and yet the team time trial element of it is absolutely critical, because they have to be in contention when they come to that sort of almost Madison slingshot they'll have up the final climb. So that will be a really interesting one to watch on stage three. There's a rare opportunity for the sprinters. Stage five, the Parc de Oiseaux. I'm not sure if you've been there, Graham. It's a kind of a bird park with huge aviaries, and some of the birds are semi-wild as well. Mark Cavendish won a Tour de France stage there 10 years ago. I remember it quite well for that reason.
I don't think I've been. It's a longer stage, isn't it, this one? 195, so just short of 200K, yeah. 195.8. So it's you know, a classic sort of sprint stage, really.
Yeah. And then it's really all about the last three stages, the stage six to Crest Volante. I mean, that is probably better known as the Col de Saisy, the final climb there. Then a very hard finish on the Grand Colombier on the final Saturday. And finally, a really short, sweet stage, only 120 kilometres, but it finishes at the Plateau de Solaison, which is the same finish as stage 15 of the Tour de France. It's also where Jonas Vingegaard and Primoz Roglic did a 1-2 for Jumbo-Visma in the 2022 Dauphiné. Vingegaard won the stage and Roglic took the GC. The race may well be decided on that final climb, certainly been set up that way. So we will see how it all unfolds, but I'm really looking forward to it, just because I know we all anticipate the biggest name riders going head-to-head-to-head, but I think there's so much of an intriguing narrative around Paul Seixas and the rest. You know, we're going to see some riders that they're not going to be almost sort of beaten into submission by the tactics of Visma and UAE with their strongest riders. So it's not like seeing how they stack up against the very, very best. It's almost a race within a race among the rest of the GC riders. And that might be quite liberating for some people, to go out on a limb and take a risk and try and lay down a marker before the Tour.
In the same way that we've seen Vingegaard do at the Giro, I think that can only be good for Seixas and any of the other GC riders who are out there for the not Dauphiné. But in the same way that Vingegaard has been sort of allowed to show that he is still
without Pogacar, or can, still can be, the dominant rider, this can only be good for Sexas's confidence. And so what you hopefully get when we get to the end of June is three or four riders who can say they've won a major stage race, so they've, I mean, fingers crossed, won the Giro. Maybe Sexas has podiumed or done better at the Tour of Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. And it sets us up for an absolute treat at the Tour.
Well, we'll be back to talk about the Dauphiné, not Dauphiné, next week, won't we? It'll be underway. We'll pick our day to record carefully, Graham, so we've got something to analyse, maybe after the team time trial, but ahead of those final three mountain stages. And we'll see how everyone is stacking up against each other at that midway point in the race.
And we'll write out our lines, our Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes lines in between.
It is not called the Dauphiné. It is not called the Dauphiné.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also brought to you by Saily, which is an eSIM for your mobile phone to help you to reduce quite dramatically the cost of using your mobile phone when you're abroad. Now, Saily is brought to you by the same people as NordVPN. So internet security is their watchword, so you know that the Saily app is safe and reliable. And it cuts out a lot of the additional costs of using your mobile phone when you're travelling abroad. Now, back in the day, we used to have to either rack up significant roaming charges when using our phones overseas, or you'd buy another SIM card from the airport and replace it in your phone while on holiday. All of that faff is eliminated by Saily because it's an eSIM. It's an app. You just download it once and then you sign up for the data plan, which covers wherever you're traveling. And it's very easy to use. And because you are a cycling podcast listener, you can download the Saily app in your app store and use the code cycling at checkout to get 15% off your first data plan purchase. And once you've got the Saily app activated, you can use your mobile phone as if you were at home without those roaming charges escalating and getting out of control. Because let's face it, whenever we're abroad, we want to use our phone the same way we do at home, keeping in touch with people, using social media, downloading your favourite podcasts. So get an exclusive 15% discount on your first Saily data plan by using the code cycling at checkout. Either download the Saily app from your app store or go to saily.com/cycling. That's saily.com/cycling. They're 24/7 support. It's easy to use. And if it doesn't work with your particular device, you can get a full refund too.
So, Lionel, it's still a little way away, but in between the Not Dauphiné and the Tour de France, we've got the Tour of Switzerland too, worthy of mention, partly because, well, not only because Tadej Pogacar is riding it, presumably in an effort to tick another major stage race off of his list of and sort of complete the set, as it were, but it's also a revamped, sort of shorter, sharper race, five stages, and each stage will start and finish in the same place.
Yeah, this is really interesting, actually. I mean, the Tour de Suisse had traditionally been kind of the fourth biggest stage race in the world, not least because it was longer than the kind of the other week-long stage races for a lot of the years that it's been held. I think in later years they had to have a dispensation to have, you know, 9 or 10 stages rather than 7 or 8. But it's a very well-respected race. You know, at its kind of height in the 80s and early 90s, I think the longest it got was 11 days. And so it is a bit of a surprise to see it reduced down to five stages now. It feels a little bit truncated, but there is actually a good reason for that. And I think the organisers and the race director, Olivier Sen, have put quite a clever format together, because what they're doing is they are holding the men's and women's races on the same courses at the same time. So the women's stages will take place in the morning on the same route as the men's stages, which will take place in the afternoon. And they're on circuit, so as you say, they start and finish in the same place. On some of the days, the women are doing like maybe one circuit less. All of the stages for both races are pretty short. I mean, the longest men's stage is 157 kilometres. The longest women's stage is 120 kilometres. And while you might think, well, that's not ideal preparation for Tadej Pogacar ahead of the Tour de France, you know, I mean, is this going to be almost a sort of detraining effort? They're all pretty hard stages. They'll be intense for sure because they're shorter. But I think looking at the bigger picture, the organisers are trying to look at the middle distance to work out how to preserve the Tour de Suisse for the medium and longer term, because it's clear that the sport calendar needs a complete revamp. And I think trying things like this to see whether it works on a logistical basis, whether it works on a broadcasting basis, whether it will attract the audience to watch, you know, the women's race in the morning and then the men's race in the afternoon, you know, that's something that we don't really know fully the answers to at the moment. But I think the sport is crying out for this sort of synergy. And it's something also the Lloyd's Tour of Britain has done, isn't it? You know, reducing the men's race by a day and bumping the women's race up by a day to ensure parity, synergy. Critics could say, well, why are the women racing a shorter distance than the men? And I think that given the distance of the stages, that is a valid point. There's no reason why the women couldn't do the same length stages as the men. But I suspect it's to do with the logistics of the road closure, that, you know, how much of the day is taken up with the cycling, because, you know, it's going to be a sort of 8-hour day of road closure. So it's a significant investment by the local authorities and the towns and the regions that are hosting the stages. But I think ordinarily you would think a race like the Tour de Suisse, you know, gradually coming down in days, you know, as recently as 2019, it was still 9 stages. It's been 8 for the last few years. To see it reduced on the men's race to 5, you would think, well, this is becoming diminished. But I actually don't think that's the case. I think it's actually more important to have an event that is trying something different, and it's trying to address some of the challenges that the sport as a whole is facing in terms of putting on races of a really high calibre that are safe, that are well organised and run, and that can attract an audience to watch both men's and women's cycling. And I'm going to be really keen to see how both of the races play out.
On the men's side, it's not just Tadej Pogacar who will be lining up on the start line. Matthew van der Poel, another headline name, alongside Tom Pidcock, alongside the lesser spotted Primoz Roglic.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it's a good field, isn't it? And we always see this at this time of year. You know, the half the Tour de France field tends to go to the Dauphiné and half goes to the Tour de Suisse, or maybe it's, in recent years, it's probably been 60-40 in favour of the Dauphiné. But it's a last sort of hit out for riders that are trying to earn their place in the Tour de France teams. And the fact that it doesn't overlap with the Dauphiné either. I mean, previously the Dauphiné would finish and the Tour de Suisse would get underway before the Dauphiné had concluded. I'm not suggesting that in future people are going to, you know, rush to do both the Dauphiné and the Tour de Suisse before the Tour de France. That might be a bit too much preparation for, you know, a grand tour. But the fact that they're not clashing, I think, gives a bit of clarity, and it sort of redefines the role of the Tour de Suisse. You know, it gives riders who perhaps have, you know, suffered illness or injury early in the season and had their training disrupted, it gives them a sort of a shorter, perhaps less onerous way to kind of rebuild form over 5 days and make a late bid for a place in the Tour de France. So I think, you know, changing the way the calendar all kind of locks together, I think this is a positive step, and maybe there are other areas of the year and the season that could kind of take inspiration from this if it works out well.
It almost gets, not forgotten is the wrong word, but it does sort of blend into what's around it a little bit. And so revamping it for that reason is a great idea. I mean, complete agreement on that. Side note too, what an absolute joy to cover. It will turn the, if you're starting and finishing in the same place, it would turn the brunch sprint into something of a canter, because you don't have to worry about going from the start village to the, you know, the finish town 200 kilometers away if you're going round the race.
Yeah, I think lots of people have been saying this for a number of years, haven't they, about how beneficial circuit races can be for stage races. And part of me, part of the grand tours, the whole the fun of it is that journey of A to Z via all of the other letters. You know, the fact that the whole thing, the travelling roadshow, unfolds over such a long period of time. But I think in the shorter stage races, it makes much more sense, doesn't it? It's giving them greater focal point. It might, if this became a regular format, it would give crowds, a boost, because there are key places to all gather. A sense that there's less travelling for the riders in between the stages. I know that was a bit of a grumble following the Giro d'Italia, which kind of once again sort of stretched everybody's patience a bit thin. And I think when we're watching on TV, that's an aspect of the sport that we really don't sort of see or appreciate, because we turn on our TV and they're all just there again, and we don't sort of see any of the 200 kilometres that they've maybe had to travel in the team bus in between. So I think in terms of sort of sustainability and just creating a sport that is less stressful and strenuous and places less strain on everybody that's involved, I think it's definitely worth trying. And I can see other stage races adopting this. Whether you could have a Paris-Nice, which is literally defined by the journey from Paris to Nice, on this sort of format, I'm not sure. But I think that we're reaching a point where the calendar needs a bit of innovative thinking. And as I say, fair play to the Tour de Suisse for, you know, sort of grasping the nettle and trying something different before the economic circumstances force them to try something different. But in terms of this as a dream scenario, with my cycling podcast business hat on, Graham, a week spent in Switzerland, I'm not sure our budget would stretch to that. If you remember the world's most expensive Burger King during our couple of hours in Switzerland at the end of last year's Tour de France, where I had a bit of a sense of humour failure, not least because I think a burger, chips and onion rings turned out to be about 30 quid.
It was the permit to get onto the Swiss motorway in the first place. I think that was what tipped you over the edge.
I knew that was coming. To buy an annual permit for the motorway when I knew we were only going about 75 kilometres was... sense of humour failure. But it's a beautiful country, isn't it, Switzerland? Beautiful country, and it would be a nice race to sit and watch. It's a perfect sort of summer holiday race, I think.
It will be a breath of fresh air, this one, and a sort of nice chance to take a breath before the tour. What else have we missed in May and the first couple of days of June, for that matter, while the Giro has been going on? I tell you what, I'll start us off with the Tour de Wallonie, the Etias Tour de Wallonie. Jordi Meus for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe took stage one. Ben Oliver, the Kiwi, taking stage two for Modern Adventure Pro Cycling. George Hincapie's sort of foray back into the pro cycling world. And Lawrence Pithy for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe again took yesterday's stage three, just ahead of Kim Heiduk for Net Company Ineos. And it's Heiduk who, after his two podium finishes along the way, that puts him in the leader's jersey as we record on Thursday morning. Still two stages to come, of course.
Yeah, there was a lot of racing going on while the Giro was on, and of course our focus was on the Giro d'Italia, but riders who are perhaps building towards objectives later in the season were sort of squirreling away victories. It was funny, really, across the month of May, away from the Giro, the same names kept coming up time and again, really. Benoit Cosnefroid of UAE Team Emirates, who isn't at the moment on the long list for the Tour de France, which perhaps might surprise a few, but he's had a great month. He won the Grand Prix du Morbihan in Brittany. He was then sixth in the Trobro-Lyon, a great race, in Brittany, famous for the Ribéo, the little farm tracks. Simon Gill and I went there a number of years ago now. Feels like yesterday, but it's probably a decade ago now. It's a really great race, Trobro-Lyon. It does get overshadowed a bit by the Giro. Still waiting for the Tour de France to take the big race to the Ribéo and be bold and brave and take on those farm tracks. The race was won by Filippo Fiorelli of Visma. There was the Tour de Hongrie in Hungary, which was won by Jakob Söderqvist of Lidl, ahead of Cosnefroid. They each won a stage, and Tim Melier, who will be at the Tour de France for Lidl Trek, won the other three. The Classic Dunkerque, which is now a one-day race, split off from the 4 days of Dunkerque, which actually lasts for 5 days, if you're following all of this. Isn't cycling wonderful? The Classic Dunkerque is a one-day race basically because there are more UCI points on offer for a one-day race. So rather than have a stage and make it a six-day, 4 days of Dunkirk, as it used to be, the organisers have kind of made the classic Dunkirk a standalone one-day race in order to attract bigger teams to come and ride the two events, because, you know, they know that more points are on offer. And Artem Schmidt of Net Company Ineos won that race. It was the same day that Filippo Ganna won the Giro time trial. The first victories in the new team jersey with the new name. I don't know what time Schmidt crossed the line. I don't know what time Ganna's victory was confirmed. So it's going to come down to, a matter of probably hours or maybe even minutes, who got Net Company Ineos's first win. Was it Schmidt or Ganna? The 4 days of Dunkirk five days. Lawrence Pithy won that overall for Red Bull. He took the first stage and held the pink jersey all the way to the finish. And there was a victory there for Victor Papon, Rasmus Tiller, Nathanael Tesfatsian, and Jordi Meus as well. So some riders in good form. Really? Then came the Boucle de la Mayenne, another small French stage race. Again, Benoît Cosnefroy won that, including a stage victory. His UAE teammate Julius Johansson won the prologue. And Olaf Coy, riding his first race for Decathlon after joining them from Visma Lisa Bike, he won two sprint stages there. He's had a bad winter, hasn't he, because he had a virus. It disrupted all of his training, delayed his start to the season, but two wins on his first appearance for Decathlon at the Boucle de la Mayenne. And next up for him is the Baloise Belgium Tour in a couple of weeks. And, well, whether he's done enough to force his way onto the long list for Decathlon and give them somebody to get behind for the sprints, that's going to be a question for the team management. Mark Renshaw's cautious about the Tour de France at this stage. I suspect it probably hinges on how he goes at the Belgium Tour and whether they divert resources away from Paul Seixas. But a real embarrassment of riches for Decathlon at the moment.
And for UAE, I mean, that run for Cosnefroy, it's almost impossible for them to leave him out if he continues that into the Tour of Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. It's to go back to the sort of football lingo, impossible not to put him on the plane.
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, that's what these races are for, isn't it? At the moment, he's supposed to be racing in Romania at the Sibiu Tour on the day the Tour de France starts. But like you say, Graham, if he has a stellar Tour de France and you know, he can be of use to Pogacar. I think the thing is with Cosnefroy is he's such a kind of puncher, isn't he? He goes out and hunts these victories on the courses that suit him. Punchy, you know, he's a kind of Brabantse Pail, Paris Camembert, a Breton Classic. I mean, that gives you an idea of the types of course that he is good at. He's won in Quebec as well, over in Canada before. And in fact, that win in Morbihan was his fourth. He's won it 3 years in a row. So would he get the license to ride that kind of race at the Tour de France when everything's for Pogacar? Not entirely sure. So it may just come down to the fact that he's not quite the right profile of rider for the Tour.
So where does that leave us? We have got a week of high altitude training ahead, you and me, before our return. In the meantime, you can follow our coverage of the women's Giro with Rose, not Denny. He's done his stint, Lizzie and Rebecca. And, well, we shall look forward to picking up halfway through the Tour of Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes, which I'm going to go and write out 100 times now and do so every day between, well, this afternoon and when next we speak, Lionel.
Yeah, I get the need to give the sponsors value, but it's not snappy, is it? It's not snappy.
I like the not Dauphiné as a holder. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll see how it all plays out and we'll pick it up next week, Graham. Look forward to it.
Looking forward to it.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The GameTime app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time Guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.